focus. And the other one is building more prosperous, livable, sustainable communities.
Okay.
So it's like, economic development, community development, quality of life. They tend to approach it from kind of a fiscal conservative libertarian perspective. Try to stay away from the culture war issues and really let someone else fight those battles. And just what does it take to have
more? I'm going to get a little higher. I'm going to stand up to start with.
Sounds good.
Yeah, and then we can move it down. Right?
Well, we certainly.
We going to stand up or not?
We've got to kind of take it. Well, the politicians.
Yeah, we're ready.
In the hands of the politicians,
pardon?
And God knows.
Yep, showtime.
Everything is just a mess.
But we need everyone at the table, including the politicians, for things to move forward.
Yeah, they're always going to be at the table. We don't have to worry about that. Anyway, so I think we do write about a lot of stuff that no one else is writing about, a lot of perspectives.
First of all, thank everyone for coming. And especially we'd like to thank Tuan, who has been kind enough to open this space at Seaville Coffee. Juan is not only a businessman, he's also a father and a husband and a graduate of the Darden Business School, and he cares about all of those things because primarily he's a taxpayer in Virginia. This is what we need to bring forward is the taxpayer issue. But we can't forget the fact that there are other things going on, like the health of our children. So I want to thank everybody for coming. Please help out Tuan's business, and if you haven't bought a cup of coffee yet, go do it. Okay. He is, first of all, a businessman. My name is Randy Salzman, and I put this together primarily just me. There is no organization behind it. I am just an individual. I am a taxpayer in Virginia, a taxpayer in the United States, a taxpayer in the city of Charlottesville, and a taxpayer in Albemarle County. And my research, what I try to make a living at, and I don't come anywhere close to, is I try to make a living researching and writing about transportation. I have done a lot of research on this project, and I promise you it is all pain and no gain to Charlottesville and Albemarle County. All pain, no gain. The great senator from Illinois, Everett Dirksen, once said, a million here and a million there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money. We are talking about $240+ million that we don't have as a state. We are talking about a project which the governor of our state says we should eliminate gasoline taxes, but yet we're going to pay back this project with gasoline tax money. If it's such a great idea to build this project, Mr. Governor, why won't Uncle Sam take your advice and eliminate gasoline taxes too, leaving Virginia taxpayers with over $240 million in bonds to pay off? This is a serious financial issue. I spoke with Jim Rich yesterday for about an hour on the phone. Jim Rich, as most of you all know, is our former, just recently pushed out of office, Commonwealth Transportation Board member. And he put it like this. Absolutely, this is a scam on the Virginia taxpayer. Absolutely, this is a scam. Specifically, the scam can be laid out a lot of ways, but the fast-track design-build process is tailor-made to be built with change orders and yet make the budget look to the taxpayer like it's possibly reasonable. As most of y'all know, including the several Darden business professors here, the University of Virginia right now is trying to get the southern terminus changed from the Skanska branch design. Why are they doing this? Because, in the words of somebody who ought to know at the Darden campus, the highway will decimate Darden Business School. And though they're trying to get it changed, of course, what that will add when it's thrown back on the taxpayers in the first of a whole series of change orders will be at least $25 million that we will have to pay because we're not going to have gas tax to pay for it in the future. We have a variety of speakers today over primarily the financial issue, okay? But I'm going to talk, first of all, a little bit about congestion. The highway has been sold locally as if it's going to solve Charlottesville, Albemarle County's congestion. The reality is it is going to bring 18-wheeler trucks to Hollymead and Forest Lakes. They're going to dump them on our most growth population areas. Why is that? Because VDOT does not claim, Virginia Department of Transportation does not claim that this highway does anything for Charlottesville transportation. What it claims is it might allow the downstate companies in Lynchburg and Danville to get to Washington, D.C. and New York a little bit faster. Mr. Bacon over here, who I'll introduce in just a second, did the analysis. They might save 2 minutes and 40 seconds to get to Washington, D.C., a five-hour drive, or 2 minutes and 40 seconds to get to New York City, a 10-hour drive. Is that worth the expenditure of $240 million? In the end, it won't save any congestion anyway. The research is absolutely clear that when you build more highway capacity, you instantly get more driving. The minute you get more driving, you eliminate the value of your highway capacity. It's very clear it's called induced traffic. Do not trust Randy Salzman on this one. Go do the research yourself if you think this is actually going to help Charlottesville traffic. We're going to have three folks speaking. Our first one is going to be Erica Herz. Erica, like Twan, is a graduate of the Darden Business School. She's an MBA. But most importantly, as she emphasizes to me, she's the mother of two young children at Greer Elementary. If you have looked at the highway map, and there's one back by Twan right back there, if you looked at the map, this is going to be so close to Greer that a pop foul from their softball field that exists today, it will land on the highway right away. Uncle Sam, the EPA, doesn't have any rules and regulations, but 2 years ago in December, they announced that if you have a highway within a half mile, if you have a school within a half mile of a major highway, you should begin to see what you're doing to student lungs, student asthma, and student autism. We're about to build a new highway that we can't afford within a quarter mile of six area schools that will dead end into the Darden Business School and decimate the campus. After her, we're going to have Eric Zimmerman here to my right. I've got my reading glasses on and I can't see that well. Eric is from the Taxpayers from Common Sense out of D.C. He and his organization, he's their transportation analysis, has been studying this whole issue and how we spend dollars forever, right, really. And they have focused on this particular project as one of the eight worst in the nation. One of the eight worst in the nation. And yet, Virginia taxpayers are going to be on the tab for $240 million. After him, finally concluding, is Jim Bacon. Jim Bacon is at Bacon's Rebellion. He is the former editor-publisher of Virginia Business. He understands money. And he has gone to the trouble of doing the only, get this, the only return on investment on this particular highway. The only one. For our $240 million, according to Jim's analysis, we're going to get $8 million in public benefits. There is not a single business on the planet, even in communist Soviet Union, if it was still around, that would build a highway that got $8 million in benefit for $240 million in expenditure. It's absolutely absurd. And the fiscal conservatives in this room, and I hope there are a lot, the fiscal conservatives in our state, and I hope there are a lot because I'm one too, should remember what Ronald Reagan told us. Government is not the solution. Government is the problem. We need to stop this highway right now. So please welcome Erica Herz. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you to Sauls and the organizers of the event, and especially thank you to Twan for hosting us at Seville Coffee today, one of all of our favorite places. My husband and I have been homeowners in Albemarle County for 13 years, and as Sauls said, are the parents of two elementary school students. And I speak to you today on behalf of moms and dads and grandparents who want our state to invest in projects that pay back in terms of the health and economic success of the next generation. The proposed Western Bypass, as you all know, as designed, will run adjacent to six local schools, including an estimated 500 feet from Greer Elementary School buildings. We have a little picture up here, likely visible from the windows of these beautiful new kindergarten classrooms that enhance learning for those who use them. Your tax dollars paid for these wonderful classrooms, and your tax dollars would also pay for the proposed bypass, the highway noise, vehicle emissions, and concrete vista from which would degrade the experience of the students in these same classrooms. Needless to say, I am amazed that in the wonderful state of Virginia, filled with some of the most educated people in the world, and at a time in history when we know about the health impacts of vehicle exhaust, that we would consider putting this proposed bypass next to several elementary schools, a junior high school, and a high school. Do we care more about saving drivers literally just a few minutes of commuting and delivery time than about the health of our children? Our tax dollars pay for the health care of those who can't pay for it themselves, so we should be very financially wary of state projects that have negative health consequences, such as this one with regard to asthma and respiratory health. For 8 years, my husband and I owned and lived in a home in the county that was adjacent to the westbound Barracks Road exit of the 250 bypass. At nights, even with the windows closed, I was woken up by the sound of trucks using their engines to brake. And on many occasions during rush hour, I had to take my children inside from playing due to the smell of vehicle exhaust. I recommend that the proponents of the proposed bypass imagine it was their child or grandchild who had to endure the noise of trucks braking and the smell of exhaust daily. Many children go to Greer Elementary School, then Jewett Middle School, then Albemarle High School, which means 180 days a year times 13 years that he or she has to have outdoor play and exercise within a quarter mile of a highway. Those children breathe not our fresh Albemarle County air, but air compromised by vehicle exhaust, and they hear that constant background noise and loud popping sounds of trucks using their engines to brake, as I've said. Over the past few years, county citizens have had to weather budget cuts for schools, as well as other losses of services due to the economic slowdown. For example, when my neighborhood association complained to VDOT that it wasn't mowing the islands on Barracks Road frequently enough to the point where it was a visibility and a safety issue, we were literally told that VDOT did not have the funds for more regular mowing. I'm not kidding. We're now experiencing an economic recovery, but if we're going to allocate millions of taxpayer dollars to a transportation project, rather than investing that money in school infrastructure, teacher salaries, public servant salaries, job retraining programs, and other programs that build the community for the future, let's at least do a smart project. This proposed bypass neither incorporates modern urban planning practices nor addresses long-term transit challenges, and it certainly does not prioritize the health and well-being of our precious next generation. In conclusion, we all need to let our state leaders know by email, phone, and even in person that we do not support this transportation investment and that we would like a constructive new process for contributing our recommendations for an effective and visionary project for our future. Thank you.
And now, Eric Zimmerman from the Taxpayer of Common Sense on the National Perspective.
Thanks, Sauls. For those not familiar with the work of Taxpayers for Common Sense, we're a nonpartisan federal budget watchdog. We seek to achieve a responsible federal government that operates within its means. Now, I was going to insert a joke here about the government operating within its means, but they're either all too depressing or made us look bad as an organization. So I'm going to skip that. We do this generally by identifying and working to eliminate unnecessary, inefficient, and wasteful programs and projects within the federal government. A little bit more about us. Our general areas of focus include transportation and infrastructure, energy, national security, agriculture, and general budget and appropriations issues. You can learn a whole lot more about us at our website, which is www.taxpayer.net. And I've also left some reports and other things about us at the table on your way out. I really do appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today to talk about a project that's actually long been on our organizational radar, the Charlottesville 29 Bypass. In fact, the bypass was actually included in one of the very first publications that our organization put out, our 1996 Road to Ruin report, in which we identified a number of transportation projects from across the nation whose costs outweighed their benefits. Since then, the bypass has appeared in several more Road to Ruin reports, including the most recent version in 2004. In addition, we've included it in our Green Scissors report the last couple times that we've put that out, and even included it in a recent proposal to Congress regarding how to avoid the blunt budgetary instrument of sequestration with a more carefully considered list of cuts. The bypass project, as it's proposed today, faces many of the same problems as it did in 1996, and as I'm reminded, long before, but we got involved in 96. Chiefly, it costs far too much money and has far too few benefits. At present, cost estimates, federal taxpayers will be on the hook for about $200 million of the $245 million project costs, yet the improvements in terms of congestion and travel time will be minimal at best. And while I could go on and on about the many questionable aspects of the project, I know Jim will do an excellent job of getting into the particulars, the local particulars, especially on the bypass. So I want to take a step back and talk about why the project is bad from a federal taxpayer standpoint. First, I'll start with a fact that will surprise nobody in this room. The federal government is broke, or nearly broke at least. We are running trillion-dollar budget deficits every year, and we are now at a $16.5 trillion national debt, constantly bumping up against a debt ceiling that must be increased with regularity. Second, a fact that won't surprise many of you either, the nation's transportation system is also broke, or very nearly so. Federal gas tax receipts are lagging, the result of increasing fuel economy, flat or decreasing rates of vehicle miles traveled, and Congress's failure to increase the tax rate on gasoline since 1996. As a result, the formerly flush Highway Trust Fund is now relying on tens of billions of dollars from the Treasury to keep it operating. In this environment, the political reality is that Congress is in little mood to spend piles of new money on piles of new projects. With limited funding and little political will to increase the amount available to spend, Congress last year passed a transportation bill called MAP 21 that was just 2 years in duration. Bills used to be 6 years. They couldn't come up with enough money to do 6 years, so they did two. And that was only after many years of extension, short-term extensions to the program. I think there was 10 extensions in total before they came up with a new bill. Even though it was only a two-year bill, Congress needed to take $20 billion from the Treasury in order to cover the amount that would not be covered by the gas tax. What was once a system, our nation's transportation system, paid for by the users of that system, has now become a burden for all taxpayers. And what the transportation system faces when the current bill expires in 2014 is nothing short of its own fiscal cliff. And this, I'll explain this chart briefly. But according to the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, which is the official bookkeeper for the federal government, the situation is nothing short of dire. Even if we assume, as this chart does, that that gas tax receipts remain steady, and they very well could continue to go down. And even if we assume steady levels of spending, and there's some argument that they should increase given the increasing needs and the increasing cost of construction. So even if we assume those two remain level, the deficit is projected to be massive. Between now and 2022, as this chart illustrates, the shortfall will be $75 billion. And that's just the highway account of the Highway Trust Fund. The transit account is going to be another $34 billion short. In total, that's $109 billion over just 10 years to keep us at stasis, to keep us where we currently are today in terms of spending and income. Third, things are obviously a little better here in Virginia, where the governor, as I'm sure all of you are very well aware, has proposed a radical restructuring of the transportation funding mechanism in an attempt to secure more funding for infrastructure projects. His proposal would turn the user pays principle on its head, however, and is not a proposal we support. But many years of one of the lowest state gas tax rates in the nation has left the Commonwealth in a precarious position when it comes to paying for transportation projects. And the radical nature of this proposal illustrates the difficulty of the situation. And then one thing I wanted to add, there was just a story this morning in the Washington Post, some polling done by the National Capital Region Transportation Planning Board. And basically their conclusion is that everybody agrees that congestion is a huge problem and nobody wants to pay for any of the solutions. No shock there. So now that I've painted an extremely gloomy picture of the funding situation, I ask you a simple question. Given that money for transportation is likely to be extremely hard to come by in future years, how much sense does it make to build a project where the benefits are barely, if any, greater than the costs? The simple fact is that doing more with what we have is the new name of the game. Under these new fiscal restraints, new infrastructure projects will be expected to pay for themselves in the open marketplace of competition for private funds, or will be expected to prove their worthiness in terms of drastic benefit on the national or at least regional level, or will be assessed based on how well they help achieve a prescribed set of performance metrics regarding congestion, safety, and system reliability, which are being considered and established right now in the wake of new requirements contained in MAP 21. In all of these regards, the bypass project looks more and more like a dinosaur. Born in an age when it might thrive, but unable to survive in the changing realities it later faced. The bypass was first conceived of at a time when there was plenty of highway money flowing from Washington. One could dream up virtually any project and have a chance at getting funding for it. But in the newer, brighter light of tighter budgets, it is inconceivable that a project with such minimal impact on congestion, such negligible improvement in travel time, and such generally limited benefits would remain on the books. Even worse, there is legitimate concern that the existing design bid was shoehorned to make it fit the pre-prescribed $245 million price tag. By keeping the cost of construction to $136 million, the winning bidder, as I'm, again, sure most people in this room are aware, made changes to design that will further reduce the benefits and utility of the road, making this an even worse deal for taxpayers from a benefit-cost perspective. Additional questions continue to surround whether the winning bid will even fulfill the requirements laid out by Virginia DOT in its request for proposal. Another vital consideration in these lean budgetary times must be getting more from the investments that we have already made. We, as an organization, have long advocated the notion of fix it first as an efficient approach to infrastructure investments. That is not to say there is never a place for new roads or highways, but maximizing the utility of existing facilities should be the first consideration. In this regard, it would be wise to consider the proposed alternatives to the bypass that would improve travel conditions on the existing 29 for both through and local traffic. Though we are no fans of creating any more bureaucratic hoops than are absolutely necessary, in this case, there have been sufficient questions raised about the project that additional study does seem to be merited. A more complete reevaluation of the project is warranted and would give the community a better view of the benefits and impacts of the project as it is currently proposed. This would also serve as a marker for federal taxpayers whether or not this is a project worthy of significant public investment. It would serve project supporters well to quantify the benefits, which we have not seen. As was pointed out, some of the only analysis was done by a private individual. To quantify the benefits of the project in monetary terms so that we have the necessary information to make decisions about this project. Now, that isn't to say that I think that this project would find support if they did all that. In fact, I think that they would find that it doesn't meet any kind of cost-benefit analysis that would make this project seem to make any sense. But at the very least, I think the FHWA needs to move forward with a new evaluation of this project if they move forward at all. If you look at the numbers on how much has already been spent on this project, it's actually quite astounding over the last 20 years or so. I think $40 or $50 million has already been spent. And that will be used as an argument as to why we should continue. But that's a terrible, terrible reason to spend $200 million going forward, because you've already spent $50 million to date. So with that, I'll conclude and say I look forward to questions and answers, and I look forward to what Jim has to say.
Thank you, Saul. I appreciate you inviting me to be here.
as a lifelong journalist, I do feel a little bit awkward being on this side of the microphone. I'm much more accustomed to covering press events and kind of standing back in the room like Sean Tubbs is doing right now. But I will try to overcome my natural anxiety at being in front of the microphone. What I want to do is leave you with a one basic message, and that is the transportation policy of the Commonwealth of Virginia should be founded upon one fundamental bedrock principle, and that is that we should prioritize transportation spending on projects on the basis of return on investment. That is, the benefits per dollar spent. To do it any other way is basically to invest, to risk the massive misallocation of billions of dollars at the hands of politicians. A year ago, I was sufficiently concerned about the Charlottesville bypass that I made an effort to calculate the return on investment myself. I am a journalist. I'm not a Darden MBA, so I'm sure people could probably quibble with my methodology, but what I do hope is at least maybe kind of make it the basis for starting to think about it, and maybe other people could come along and improve the methodology that I used. But basically what I did is I identified two main sets of benefits that would accrue to building the bypass. One would be the amount of travel time saved, which you can impute an economic value to, and the other would be the number of traffic accidents reduced. Okay, so these are the two major benefits that proponents cite when justifying the bypass. And so I went about trying to quantify what those benefits would be. I'll just walk you through really, really quickly. I'm going to throw out a lot of numbers, and I'll try to boil it down to make it comprehensible. The first step is calculating the economic event and its benefits from the time savings. And basically what I did is I live in Richmond, and I came out to Charlottesville and picked like a morning rush hour, which I figured would be the heaviest traffic during the day, and drove up and down US 29 and 250 from where the southern terminus would be, the northern terminus would be, and timed how long it took. And compare to that to how long the trip would take if you took the bypass, assuming 60 miles an hour, 6.5 miles. And basically what I came up with, it was an average time savings of about 2 minutes and 40 seconds. That's the great time benefit that you gain. Now, then what you do is apply that to the number of people, the number of vehicles will be using the bypass. And that, of course, is another thing that's kind of subject to some guessing. But I used an estimate of about 10,000 vehicles a day as a starting point when the project opens. Might be higher, might be lower, but it's in the ballpark. And then what I did is I took information from the traffic in Texas Transportation Institute, which is the foremost authority on studying the cost of traffic congestion in the United States. And these are year-ago numbers, but they say that they apply a metric of $16.30 per hour. That's what the economic cost of congestion is to individual motorists, and $88 an hour for trucks. So you just run all that through the equations, and you calculate it out over an annual basis, and you come up with an annual savings of $5.8 million a year. So it's not as if there's going to be zero benefits from this project. Yes, there will be some time savings, and there will be some benefit. The next step is I went through and tried to calculate what level of benefits would be accrued to having reduced number of accidents. Now, according to the American Automobile Association, believe it or not, the economic cost of traffic accidents and injuries and fatalities is roughly three times that of congestion in the United States today. But there doesn't seem to be a huge lobby for reducing traffic accidents, like there is a huge lobby for reducing congestion. And as a consequence, we pay a lot more attention to congestion than we do to safety issues. Be that as it may, AAA, what they do is they have their rule of thumb is that the average cost per in car repairs per accident is about $4,000. The average cost in medical bills associated with injuries is about $16,000, and the average cost of a fatality is $6 million. So I went and got the numbers for number of traffic accidents and injuries and fatalities for US 29 between the northern terminus and basically 250 bypass and the short section of the 250 bypass, and figured out how many accidents there were, and then applied all those numbers to that. Fortunately, for the Charlottesville people, the number of fatalities in that area were zero over the 3 years that I looked at. So that very expensive part of it is not really entering the equation. You do have a lot of accidents, but they tend to be kind of relatively low speed and therefore relatively low cost compared to accidents out in rural roads and things. Okay, the next thing I had to do is kind of just guesstimate, if you built this bypass, how many accidents would you reduce? And somewhat arbitrary there, and I welcome anybody to come in with any more refined numbers, but I assume is you take about 20% of the traffic off of US 29, where all these intersections and stoplights and in and out and all that kind of stuff occur. You take them, put them on the bypass, you reduce the number of accidents by about 20% overall. But then you also are adding new stoplights at the northern and southern termini of the bypass and creating very complex traffic patterns at those stoplights. And so therefore, you'll probably increase the likelihood of traffic accidents at those two locations. And I just simply took a kind of pro rata as to, as to two stoplights compared to all the other stoplights there in existence and averaged it out and came out with, well, that would add 5% more traffic accidents. You can argue one way or the other that it's more, it's less, whatever, but it's in the ballpark. So a total reduction is my assumption of about 15% in the number of traffic accidents overall. You run all the numbers, and what you come up with is an annual total savings of about $2.4 million a year. Okay? Not insignificant, but it is what it is. Okay, you take this time value, the value of the time saved, and the value of the reduced number of traffic accidents. You come up with a number of $8.4 million a year in benefits. So one last note: what I did not even try to include was any discussion of, particularly the environmental impact. There are pros and cons. On the one hand, environmental impact, you can say reduced time savings means reduced gasoline consumption and less pollution. On the other hand, you have the fact, as Erica mentioned, what pollution you do generate is going to be right next to the schools, and so that has costs. I just avoided all those, and so you can factor that into your spreadsheet if you're so inclined. But the real point here is that, okay, you can argue with it for, up or down a couple million dollars, but if you have an annual savings of $8.2 million a year, and you spend $244 million to achieve that. This is a basic concept of business. You're generating your return on investment of about 3.4% a year. Now, no business in America would make that investment to generate 3.4% a year. And even government, which has a very different set of standards, they shouldn't be generating that kind of, making that kind of investment to generate such a modest benefit. If you consider the fact that the cost of capital for the state of Virginia, we have to go out and borrow this money, and we're paying roughly, I'm not sure what the municipal bond rate is right now, it's about 3.5%, and you have to figure that that's subsidized because it's tax-free. You can argue that making this investment is literally destroying economic value because you have to compare it to the cost of capital.
Now, okay, so that was the conclusion that I reached a year ago. There have been some developments since then. As has already been pointed out, the southern terminus has been dramatically redesigned in order to bring down the cost of the project to within the amount of money allocated by the Commonwealth Transportation Board. And as a result of that redesign, the performance characteristics of the southern terminus have dramatically changed. And Bob Humphreys, I don't know if he's here today. Oh, there he is. Well, Bob should be, you should all go up and give him a big warm hug for some of the work he did, in which he just basically looked at the new design, and then he went out and talked to a number of area trucking companies and asked them, what is your, what, how would you, would this do, how would you react to this design? And to boil down to its most simplest elements, it would create a situation where you would have two stoplights for the north, for northbound traffic going up a steep incline. And if you're a heavy truck and you're starting from a dead stop at a stoplight and you're going uphill, you're not going to go very fast. And you're probably going to like come to a halt at the next stoplight, and things are going to get really bogged down, and there's going to be time delays that the McDonnell administration simply isn't taking account of. Conversely, when you're southbound coming down, you're coming down a steep incline and you're approaching a stoplight, the chances of miscalculation are significantly higher. You might overrun, you might create an accident, and given the fact that heavy trucks are involved, you might well run the risk of fatalities, in which would totally skew and totally offset any potential savings. So that's with the conclusion that Bob came to. I went to the Virginia Trucking Association, confirmed the fact that, well, they still back the bypass. I have to put in that proviso. But they confirmed that the concerns that Bob raised were legitimate. So on the one hand, what you have is a situation where if heavy trucks, given an economic value of $88 an hour, some of them might reroute and not even use the bypass at all. And then you have the increased likelihood of traffic accidents because of new configuration. You really could be obliterating the economic value, whatever semblance of economic value is to this project. So just in closing, I'll just kind of make an appeal to everybody to support the idea that we need to apply this kind of analysis and thinking to our transportation projects and in order to make rational investment decisions. One last note, and when businesses kind of, when they go through with a big budget-making process every year and they decide we've got X amount of money that we can invest, what projects are we going to put it to, they don't just look at one project in isolation. They look at it at the projects at the sum total of all the different options that are available to them. And within the Charlottesville area, there is one very important option, Places 29. Now, when the Charlottesville bypass was originally designed, Places 29 did not exist. It came about as a result of the efforts of people in the community, probably many of you, when it looked like the money was not going to be available for the bypass. This new alternative came into existence and is very well thought through and would accomplish many of the same aims for a comparable price. What the McDonnell administration failed to do when it decided to resuscitate the bypass was to consider it against the alternative of Places 29. Simply never went through that exercise. One of the things that the community could do or should do is go back that plan and say, these are the key investments that need to be made, and this is the economic impact in terms of time value saved and reduced number of accidents, and you want to calculate environmental benefits, you can, and say, this is the return on investment that we would have if we invested in the Places 29 plan. Given the fact that everyone using 29 corridor would benefit as opposed to only those using the bypass, ROI is likely to be far higher, although you don't know until you actually go through and calculate those numbers. It might be late in the game, but one thing I would urge somebody to do, I don't have the resources to do it, would be to go back and go through that exercise and compare the ROI from Places 29 and to that of the Charlottesville bypass. And I think that you would have a very, very powerful argument that hasn't existed heretofore to scrapping the bypass. Thank you.
Thank you.
Presuming that some folks have some questions or clarifications or stuff, we'll open it to the floor.
Cynthia Knapp, I'm so taken by your comments, especially about Places 29, because, you know, that has always been my problem with the bypass, is we had a solution. It's smarter, it's better, it'll actually meet our needs. But George Larry can also echo this. We are part of the Places 29 Advisory Council to the Board of Supervisors, and it's a joke. When we went to a meeting in 2010, we were told we couldn't discuss the bypass, because Ken Boyd looked at me specifically and said, we will not be discussing the bypass. It's a done deal. There's other forums you can complain about. And even today, we're unable to get the county to support us in trying to do this. So I think this kind of work is going to have to happen, with Pat Ho or somebody else if we have any prayer of doing that. Which I think makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, well, don't rely upon a forum that's been shut down. Find some other forum to do it.
Others over there?
I guess one of the things as a professor at the university I would point out is that the only people using that crossroad at the southern terminus of the bypass are university students. I mean, literally, there is no one else. So when we talk about who we're putting at risk with the plan that has giant trucks barreling down a hill with stoplight at the bottom, we know exactly who those people will be. They'll be University of Virginia students. And so I think one of the questions that some of us have is why the university has not taken a stand on this, since it is clearly our students who are being put at risk.
Yeah, and most people don't understand this about the Skanska branch design. But for 30 years, whenever they talked about the bypass, it always began on the southern side of US 250, i.e. began on the Darden Business School campus. Skanska Branch, to save immense amounts of money and get it in sounding like it's cheap, they start the bypass on the north side of US 250. So therefore, the bypass, which is an arterial road in Virginia, and in Virginia, an arterial road cannot have a scale, a grade of over 6%. But by starting it on the north side, what they can do is drop off a cliff. And they call it, it's a local road from the north side of US 250 down into the Darden Business School. It's called Leonard Sandbridge Road. Well, a local road in Virginia can have a max grade of 15%. And the Skanska branch design for this is 11.4%. Let me give you an idea of what that means. Some people here in this room have been to going to the Sun Highway in Glacier National Park in Montana. That is a phenomenal road. If you haven't been on it, you ought to go on it. It's 6%. The largest grade in the interstate highway system is not in the Rocky Mountains, by the way. It's in Tennessee, 8%. There are 35 highway mountain passes in Colorado. One is over 10%. At the bottom of this grade is going to be a stoplight. Imagine you are a driver and you see in front of you as you come down a hill at 60 miles per hour. Imagine you are an 18-wheel trucker coming down a hill at 60 miles an hour of this kind of grade, and the stoplight turns yellow on you. What do? You do not try to slow down. You punch the accelerator. 50 yards down the road is the crosswalk where students walk daily, many times with stuff in their ears, many times studying. We're going to kill a few people, and then we're going to be in real financial trouble. Yes, ma'am.
Diagram of the southern terminus, and I showed it to the guy that distributes this information.
charge of dispatching the drivers. I showed him the 90-degree turn, the stoplights, and the grade, and he shook his head and basically said, I would never put my drivers into a situation I thought was dangerous. In other words, they're still going to go 29, so all this plan to get the trucks off the 29 ain't going to happen that way.
Response? Anybody? Yes,
well,
ma'am.
My husband was a civil engineer, and he says that what they're going to be doing is design changes as soon as everything is, you know, ratified. And design changes mean increased costs. And, you know, they're going to be putting in design changes. And his big question is, who's going to be paying those costs? And the answer is taxpayers of Virginia.
That is the exact reason that Mr. Rich, our former Commonwealth Transportation Board member, calls it a scam on the taxpayer.
And so, you know, that's added costs. And the design changes mean making cuts through the mountain. And making cuts through the mountain means big rocks. And big rocks mean big costs. You know, we just put in something in our backyard, which is over near there, and we were pulling out boulders. We are pulling out boulders out of our backyard. You know, that mountain is nothing but rocks.
Do any of y'all want to respond there? Well, the Federal Highway Administration, I think in 2009, but I don't remember the exact year, they compared 16, if I remember the number correctly, but a large number of design bid projects, design build projects with design bid build projects. And what Uncle Sam concluded is that on a design build project, you save 1% of the time, 1%, and you increase the cost dramatically. And the reason you increase the cost dramatically is because of just that. It's all set up. It's planned that the money is going to be made in these change orders, these cost overruns. And the taxpayers and the media are not there at that time. If you don't stop it up front, then you pay for it down the line. I'm sorry, and Mr. Rooker back there.
Well, I think it's instructive to note that before this was approved by the CTV in late July, the Secretary of Transportation had his own internal cost estimating department doing cost estimates on the project, and he had the pace of their work accelerated, presumably because he wanted a cost number to take the Commonwealth Transportation Board. The numbers that they determined internally, the road would cost, were $100 million to $200 million more than we presently have on the table. He did not disclose that information to the Commonwealth Transportation Board when he went for approval of the project. Those numbers came out in a Freedom of Information Act request, and they didn't come out until, I think, September, following the approval by the CTV. So they knew internally that if they built a road that was functional, did not have a southern terminus, that obviously does not work. If they added the lanes on 29 North as a part of melding into existing 29 that they had promised they were going to do but are in the stance at the time, this project was going to cost a whole lot more than what the Secretary of Transportation took to the Commonwealth Transportation Board. He used figures that had been determined internally at the Culpeper office that had not gone through any rigorous engineering analysis. They were almost envelope-type estimate numbers. The governor will be gone if this road is ever built. The Secretary of Transportation will be gone. It will be a different Commonwealth Transportation Board. And all they will be looking at, all the new people will be looking at, is cost overruns and change orders to try to make this a functional road if, in fact, it goes forward. So, again, according to their internal estimates of VDOT, they had 8 engineers going back and forth working on this, according to their email correspondence, 100 to 200 million more than they currently have appropriated for this project.
So it's a 400 million highway, not a 200 million highway, basically. Over here, the gentleman had his hand up for quite a while.
Looking well forward, how much would this disadvantage the Charlottesville area for going back to the well for highway funds? get past his prologue, if you go well north of 250 million, what about the next big cluster, whatever? And you, so how much are you going to the well now, and that we'd be disadvantaged well down the line?
I know bits and pieces of the answer. I don't know if I can't speak authoritatively. I'm calling off the top of my head. I think some of the money, the state money for this project, is coming from money that had been set aside for public-private partnerships. So it's not from necessarily from the money that was allocated to the Culpeper District, of which you're a part, is part of the six-year improvement program. Some of it may have been. I'm not clear. I think it's a really good question, and it's worth someone ought to dig into and find out. Is this going to shortchange projects that people in this area would like to have? And of course, it's well known by everybody that the Culpeper District has been shortchanged compared to places like Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads, which has just been – they've been shoveling money into those regions.
I specifically asked Mr. Rich that question when I spoke to him on the phone. And the reason I ask it is Mac Lafferty, who's had to leave, who is a member of the Albemarle County Planning Commission, I'm sorry. And Mac Lafferty had told me that if this highway is built, it will suck up one half of all of the funds that go to the entire Culpeper District from now through the year 2050. I asked that question to Mr. Rich, and he said that is right on the money. There will not be any other dollars, and other areas besides Charlottesville will want that money, and they will get it. We'll be done. It's kind of interesting that to make this somewhere close to a real bypass, the proponents are now saying, oh, we're going to extend it on for $132 million. That money does not exist now. It's not going to exist in the future. And there is not a single politician in the future who's going to be bound by today's lukewarm promises. They're not going to do it, folks. Thank you. Over there in the black.
Okay, well, some basic facts is we haven't raised the gas tax in, I don't know, since 1986. Cars are getting more fuel efficient. Inflation has eroded it. And so as a consequence, whereas we once upon a time had lots of money for new road projects, which is not necessarily a good thing, depending what you're building, but we are rapidly running out of money. And estimates are by 2017, 2018, or thereabouts. Sooner rather than later, because the situation keeps on getting worse, is there literally be no more state money left for new road construction, period, at all. You combine that with the fact that, as Eric pointed out, the federal tax dollars are likely to be diminished as well. There will be less and less money for any kind of new construction. So basically what you have is what you're going to get. Now, the McDonnell administration, what they tried to do early in the administration, because they didn't want to raise taxes, they went out and accelerated some borrowing that had been previously authorized. And so during this administration, we'd be borrowing $3 billion. There is a certain logic to it. You borrow and spend while there's kind of recession recovery going on and everything is cheaper and projects are mostly, not the bypass, but mostly coming in under estimate, and you get to borrow at low interest rates. So it does make some sense. But basically we're maxing out our borrowing capacity. And so you won't be able to borrow anymore, get any more money that way. So basically what we have is what we get, unless, now then what the governor is trying to do, he wants to restructure transportation spending, the funding formulas by scrapping the gas tax and rejiggering increasing the sales tax. And as Eric also pointed out, what that's basically doing, he's eliminating any semblance of a user fee. And a lot of people who drive long distances, they're just fine with that because they'll come out ahead. They won't have to pay the gasoline tax, and all the people who do what is a socially beneficial thing of walking to work, riding bicycles to work, telecommuting, living very near where they work, and all those kinds of things, who don't drive a lot, they will all share in the cost of paying for the transportation system through their sales tax. So depending on your sense of fairness, and mine is, I believe, in a user pay system, this is going to be immensely unfair. It's going to subsidize driving, and it's going to discourage, on the margin, it's going to discourage, make it more expensive for, just discourage all the socially beneficial behaviors. Saw one guy from the Texas Transportation Institute quoted, he suspects by scrapping the gas tax alone, that will increase over time the number of vehicle miles driven in the state by about 1.5%. So it will actually induce more driving, and the more driving you have, the way it works is the more people you have in the road, it contributes to congestion at an exponential rate. So that will add even more to congestion, and so then all of a sudden we'll be spending all this extra money, raising all this money for new transportation projects to fix a problem that we've created because we scrapped the gas tax.
Yes, ma'am. You were. Army Corps of Engineers, I understand, has asked for further
funding to help with the cost of the louder, please. The Army Corps of Engineers has come out asking against the bypass. Can you all
Both the Army Corps of Engineers and the Environmental Protection Agency have asked the Federal Highway Administration, well, they've hinted greatly that there should be a new, what's called a supplemental environmental impact statement done. That sounds like it's only about pollution, environmental impact. No, but it's about all of these facts. But this is all a political concern and a political issue. Yes. We who are opposed to this project do hope that the Federal Highway Administration says we're going to do a new SEIS, but it will still not go away until we begin to realize that in the best situation, we still can't afford it. So don't depend, please, on the Federal Highway Administration. Don't depend on the EPA. Don't depend on the Corps of Engineers here. It has to be coming from us, and I'm being very specific here. It has to be coming from us, the fiscal conservatives in this state. You know, there's some people in Richmond who dismissed the People's Republic of Charlottesville, okay? And that's exactly what they're doing right now. They're just dismissing us because we're all allegedly so lefty. My wife is standing back there. She will damn sure tell you that I'm not a lefty, okay? But we've got to bring it to the fact that there's no money for a project that does nothing that helps us. I'm sorry. Yes, ma'am. Okay, number one. Okay, the lady asked, what should we do if we think this highway should be stopped? Okay, number one. In tomorrow's paper, Sean Tubbs is back here. Sean Tubbs is likely to write an article about this for tomorrow's paper. He's also put it in Seville tomorrow, most likely. I mean, I can't promise you he's going to do that, but it's pretty likely. Clip it out of the Daily Progress. Clip it and put it in an envelope, or clip several copies, make the Daily Progress a little more wealthy tomorrow, and send it to Senator Warner, send it to Senator Kaine, send it to Governor McDonnell, send it to Secretary of Transportation, who I can never pronounce his last name. On the ones you send to the Secretary of Transportation and the Governor, just write on the side. You don't have to write anything besides government is the problem. If you send it to Senator Kaine and you send it to Senator Warner, say, where are you? We have not heard from you, Senator Warner, Senator McCain. Stand up for us. Okay? That's the first thing. The second thing is Irene Rico, IRENE.RICO, and I think that's at FHWA, but that's available from a variety of places. She's the lady who has been collecting the information. Now, it's past the point where they officially accept. But it would be nice as if she sat around to talk to the other members about what we're going to do with this SEIS. She says, suddenly, I'm getting another ton of comments. According to Mr. Tubbs reporting of about 3 weeks ago, there were 3,300 comments on the environmental impact, the environmental assessment, and about 3,100 of them were saying, don't build this highway. Okay? We need to make the powers that be know that we're going to stay on the ball. It's not going to slide back into the dark rooms that have been referred to here. Okay, and the third thing you can do is talk to your fiscally conservative friends and say, you've got to begin to do the research on this project. Look at the reality. Go to Bacon's Rebellion. Go to Taxpayers for Common Sense and study it. Because it's so simple and so easy to put it on the back burner, I'm going to get to it at some point in time. That's the reason the fast-track process appears to be working, because they specifically do not want us to know. One of the more interesting quotes from last spring, was one of our county commissioners, who is, I don't think, in this room right now. He was quoted as saying that, I think I have the exact quote here. Let me make sure that I put this down. I thought that we were going to have a public hearing, and I thought that was part of the process. I'm curious to know what VDOT has planned. This county supervisor said this according to Daily Progress on April 25th. Less than 2 weeks later, he voted against asking VDOT to have a public hearing. Now think about that. Is this a flip-flop? Is this an awfully stupid man? Or is this a negotiation?
I would have a fourth suggestion, because I think that what the Army Corps of Engineers and the EPA are doing, I mean, that's a delay. I think they are going to hopefully delay this project. But the only way you can really kill an unwise transportation project is politically. And unless we have a new governor who is opposed to this type of waste of money, it probably could be built. We also have to focus on the Board of Supervisors of Alabama County, because if we have the same board, then they're going to continue to not make any changes. But if we have some new board members who are opposed to the bypass, it will make a difference. And a wise man once told me, who's been involved in a lot of legal cases like this, he said, in the courts, you can only delay it. You have to kill it. It has to be done politically.
Mr. Bacon, Mr. Zimmerman, would you concur with his three, or do you have anything to add to that?
Concur with his what?
With his three.
I'm just a humble journalist, not a political agitator. So I will leave that to Saul. Well, I think in terms of maybe creating talking points, and again, the thing that I would go back to is, since I kind of think like an economist, not one, but I try to think like one, is to do the ROI analysis. Assuming that if you succeed in delaying the project to the next gubernatorial administration, if you can present new information to them, a new perspective to them that had not existed before, and you can compare the return on investment of the bypass versus places 29 or even doing nothing, that gives you significant new information. The other thing I want to add, just in response to your comment about the next governor, if you can kick the can down the road to the next governor, it would be really interesting to say, and I don't know the answer. We all know that, Terry McAuliffe and Ken Cuccinelli are the two prospects, likely candidates. it would be interesting to go to Virginia Public Access Project and do the research and see who's getting the road builder money and the contractor money. Just be interesting to see. I have no idea what the answer is. But whoever is getting it, you don't want them.
And that's the question I always ask in these projects when it doesn't seem to make any sense, it doesn't seem to be a project that really has a lot of merit, is you know, where are the political donations going to and coming from, and generally who are the beneficiaries, who's benefiting from the project. And if you can uncover that, we, you know, some of that may be known, some of that may be yet to be uncovered, but if you can figure that out, it at least gets you part of the way to figuring out why it's moving, and oftentimes you uncover a great story that might expose it for what it is.
I think also that, not to sound self-promoting, but this is the kind of thing, politicians always follow us, even though it doesn't seem like it, but we have to have the numbers. And for the next couple of Sunday mornings at least, I will have guests on Charlottesville this week. Salts is one of them. Eric will be another, who will be talking about this. And while you know a great deal, I have to confess, my whole opinion, I'm from New York, and the bypass, as I told Salts the other day when we recorded the show, I discovered it. I wrote on it, looked wide, beautiful, and it could only go 35 miles an hour, and I wondered what was it there for. So there are a lot of people like me really have not formed an opinion, and you should tell all of them to listen, because the interview I had with Solz and that will air this Sunday, 27th, and the one I'm about to do tomorrow with Eric are incredibly informative and really made me go, oh, well, this is important, and put in calls to Ken Boyd.
Can you say what time the show is aired?
They're on all the months. Media, and if Charlottesville this week has a new Facebook page, and it's all there. It's on all the Monticello Media stations, and they're all very early on Sunday morning for those who get up that early, but also we're working on something so that they can be downloadable, and then you can send them to friends and whatever, and links and all that good stuff. But I was turned around by that interview, and that's what I think we need. It's not the people who are all for it, it's the people who are not thinking about it. And I was one of them, and now I'm not.
I'd just like to focus on this question of what can people do. I think the recommendations that have been put forward so far are right on. But I want to follow up on something that John mentioned, and that, I think there's a lot of emphasis being put on the federal government and on the state government, who's going to win the gubernatorial election. But one of the things about highway proposals like this is our local government has the ability to pull the plug on this project. And I think the focus of our efforts, and yes, there's a local election coming up in November, but we can be putting pressure on our local government representatives before then. I think it's unlikely that they would pull the plug on this project outright, but one of the things this community has been demanding since it was first put forward, July of 2011, is let's get that honest comparison of the bypass to the alternative the community has developed. We still haven't gotten it. We've asked for that from our local government. They haven't responded. That's what we need to be asking for. And our local government could agree to do that and put the project on hold until that is done. So definitely, as important as the federal government is, as important as the state government is, I think we cannot afford to lose focus on those people who represent us most directly, those people here in our county.
The gentleman there?
Mr. Bacon, I'd like to ask you about your thoughts about sales tax and transportation, and isn't it in fact everybody that gets goods and services is a user of the transportation system? And every time I go out and buy a loaf of bread or something like that, I'm in, because it's delivered to me, I'm using the transportation. I work for Amazon and legally pay my sales tax, I'm using the transportation system. And isn't it just to say it's a user's tax a bit much? And also, how does ROI change on the project if you consider sunk costs and an increase in gas tax? Doesn't that change that pretty significantly? Gas prices pretty significantly, pretty quickly. And what is an acceptable ROI for a highway car?
Okay. sunk cost issue, I think, is a legitimate one to ask. I mean, apparently we've already spent, I don't know, something in the order of $40 million on right-of-way acquisition and engineering costs. The right-of-way acquisition can be undone. You can go back and resell the land. So you can recoup a significant amount of that. You cannot recoup your engineering costs. So, but I think you can overstate the sunk cost aspect. The gasoline, what happens if gasoline prices go up? Insofar as you can reduce gasoline consumption, that is a minor factor. But when you total the cost of the time value saved of traveling, gasoline prices are only a very small part of the total cost, because you're also comparing people's the value of their time as well as the gasoline and the wear and tear on the car. So I don't really consider those to be really significant factors. I mean, maybe a little teeny bit on the margin they are. And then you ask for something else.
Isn't everyone really a user in terms of the transportation system, because of the goods and services that are transported on there, and the use of sales tax is in fact an additional way to absorb what is actually something everyone, even without a car, uses?
Yeah. Well, right, and that's precisely the logic that the McDonald administration is using, is that, yeah, well, everybody, we all use the transportation system, we all benefit from it. Okay. I guess I would argue by analogy. We all use electricity, right? We all use telecommunications and the Internet. Why isn't the government paying? Why don't we pay that through a sales tax? Why do we have to pay for that ourselves? Why don't we, you know, the reason is because when you consume electricity, if you reduce the cost of electricity, people consume more of it. All right? If you reduce the cost of driving, people are going to drive more. Those are not consequences that you want to have. Now, I'm not one of those people who goes out and says, you know, I mean, there are some people who say, we ought to increase the gasoline tax and we ought to make driving more expensive because driving is bad. I don't feel that driving is bad. Not intrinsically. It's only bad if it's being subsidized and we're driving more than we would otherwise choose to do. So, and that's what's going to happen when you have when you abandon the user fee and you socialize the cost of driving.
Back over there, sir. Is the game over if what? I didn't quite understand.
The Federal Highway Administration finds it doesn't need to be delayed, doesn't need a supplemental EIS.
No, it would not be over at that moment, though, of course, it'll be out of the political arena and it'll be out of the administrative executive arena and into the legal arena. Not that I'm aware of. No. Obviously, Eric doesn't think there is.
Okay, so
a lawyer is over here, so. This is a political highway built for political purposes. Primarily, a downstate powerful politician has been pushing this for a long time because he believes. Well, I'm going to ask.
The speakers mentioned today that both EPA and the Corps of Engineers have hinted that they want to see the additional analysis that VDOT has and our Corps of Supervisors haven't been willing to give us to this point. And the Corps of Engineers has to grant a wetlands permit for this project to go forward. So this is not a done deal. The Federal Highway Administration decides that we're okay with this shoddy level of analysis going forward. In addition, there's been all this discussion about change orders and the problems with the southern terminus, and I think it's a very good bet that is, if the Federal Highway Administration says you may go forward on this low level of analysis, then we go to the final design phase.
VDOT this whole time has been saying, oh, don't, we don't want to hear your concerns now. Bring them up after the Highway Administration has been signed off, and we'll deal with them during the final design. Well, it's very likely, if VDOT is at all responsive to these very legitimate concerns about the design that's been put forward so far, that there will be changes during the final design phase that will increase the price of the project. Then you get back into the approvals that are required for that additional allocation of funding to cover the increase in cost. So there are still quite a few decision points left on this project. And I think the proponents of the project want people to think, they wanted people to think since last July that it's a done deal. The Federal Highway Administration comes out and says, this environmental assessment that has been done is enough. And then we're going to hear a whole other wave of it's a done deal, it's a done deal. But it's not a done deal. And I think that's why this event has been fantastic. Is, for those who don't know, I'm Morgan Butler. I'm with the Southern Environmental Law Center. Our concerns with this project are very much environmental oriented. But indeed, I think that the fiscal policy of this project is an issue that should be everyone should be talking about. So it's not a done deal. We need people who are concerned about issues other than the environment, the other very serious problems with this, to be raising these concerns at the federal, at the state, and primarily at the local level. There are more decision points left.
So, Morgan, you think the thrust of information that we could get out to our friends, et cetera, would be to inundate your board of supervisors with your concerns?
I would inundate all levels.
Well, Mr. Tubbs is recording it. It'll be on Seville Tomorrow's webpage, right?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily. Okay. You had a follow-up? I'm sorry.
My conclusion from what Morgan said, thank you for all your work on this too, is that the pressure point, primary pressure point, has been the Highway Administration. I don't know if there's an ability to comment to them or not, but the secondary one that sounds like it would be the Army Corps of Engineers. Those are the only two people at this point who can choose to delay it. Is that right?
No. Local Board of Supervisors.
Local Board of Supervisors.
General Assembly.
Just for the, there is somewhere around the tables, and there's one in the back by where Kirk in the gray shirt is standing. If you would like more information emailed to you, if you put your email, you don't have to put your name, just your email. And there is the Mr. Bacon's webpage, Mr. Zimmerman's webpage, and my personal webpage as a transportation writer has been studying this. The next question was this lady right here in the purple.
Yeah, thank you. Unfortunately, I do think a lot of people are under the impression that this is a done deal. And I just wanted to raise a question, speaking as a parent who's concerned about the environmental issues and the impact on all the school children. My understanding is that the school board has not really addressed this issue at all, and that they still need to acquire the acquisition rights on the school property. And I just wonder if it's not an opening for parents to make the displeasure known that they prefer to have basically a green shield around the schools rather than a noise-creating and pollution-creating environment. If they can't put pressure on the school board to deny permission to sell that school land.
They're proposing to take 12 and a half acres of land from the Albemarle Greer Ivy Creek Special Needs School on Jewett property. They have not bought that property yet. The school board has never weighed in on this project. They did send a letter to FHWA and ask for certain things to be done with respect to where this road is located and trying to protect the school somewhat. It's interesting to note that if you look at the current proposal, they indicate that they intend to put up no noise barriers at all for the project. They say that there is no receptor anywhere along the way of this project that qualifies under their standards, so we need to keep that in mind. And they haven't priced any noise receptors into the project. I did want to comment on the can this be stopped? You need, and someone said it was done, you know, the current decision was a political decision. The last two administrations before the McDonald administration did not move forward with the project. They both, the governors in those cases, both sent their secretaries of transportation and commissioners of transportation down to look at this project, study it, determine whether or not it should move forward. In both cases, they determined that without regard to local impact, schools, water supply, et cetera, health of students, from a state standpoint, it didn't make sense to build this project from a cost-benefit standpoint, that there was a minimal transportation benefit and that the cost was simply too exorbitant for that minimal transportation benefit. That was determined by the governor. That the same determination can be made by another governor. And the governor can clearly, whoever is the governor, can clearly pull the plug on the project. It will not be built in the current administration. We're going to have a new governor soon, and that governor will be able to take an independent look at this project. The last member of the Commonwealth Transportation Board representing our area, Butch Davies, is from Culpeper. Butch was a proponent of the bypass. Until he came down and spent some time studying where it would be built, how much it would cost, what the transportation benefit would be bestowed by it, he became an opponent of the bypass for those reasons, because of his independent study. And the same thing happened with respect to the Secretary of Transportation under Warren. That was Whit Clement, who was from Danville. Danville had long pushed for a bypass around Charlottesville. He supported a bypass around Charlottesville until he started studying the particulars of this bypass, its cost, its impacts, etc. And his comment several times at CTV meetings have been, no one who has spent any time looking at this project supports it. Now, I would believe that there would be a reasonable chance that if we get a different governor and they come in and look at this project, they will draw the same conclusion that Governor Warren's administration grew, and Governor Kane's administration grew. By the way, Governor Warren was on the Commonwealth Transportation Board that approved a bypass project back in 1990, and that was only to be built after grade separated interchanges were built on 29, by the way, and only then if the money were available and traffic still didn't work on 29. But Warner voted against this project when he was on the CTV in 1990. He said his reason was that it was obsolete in 1990. That was before Forest Lake South was built, before Hollywood Town Center was built, before North Point was approved, before the University Research Park was built, and before NGC was even agreeing to build that.
To add to Mr. Rooker's comments, I encourage you to have a PTO meeting where you invite some of the folks here to come speak and explain the issues to parents, and then create a joint letter among many, many parents to the school board, to the PTO, to the school community, and possibly work with both with other schools if you want. I'm happy to follow up with you on that.
Let's close it down because we've already taken a whole lot of his Tuan's money time. Please go buy another cup of coffee, make him really happy. Thank you, folks, for being here. Check out this web page. That's Jim Bacon's. Check out thetaxpayers.net, if I remember the title. That's Eric Zimmerman's. Erica, I'm sure, would email you her list, and there's about 24, 25 health studies that show the issues. And I'm randysalzman.com, and I will be glad to talk to anybody about it. Thank you very much for coming. Everybody
Thank
have
you.
A good day.
Thank you, Salz.
Good job, Salz.
Nice to meet you.
It was a pleasure. It's
Thank
nice
you.
To meet you. Good luck.
You don't want to stick around, I'll buy you lunch right now.